collaboration with state administration. The facility has 28 beds with high flow oxygen capacity and 72 beds with oxygen supply. We will add 100 more beds here with oxygen support system very soon.
As hospitals are scrambling to shore up oxygen supplies, the authorities have decided to install over 30 new oxygen generating plants in the region. Also, the government is constructing a 500-bedded COVID hospital in central Kashmir's Budgam district.
The work on this project is to be completed within 35 to 40 days. The hospital will have 125 beds as intensive care unit, and rest of the beds will have oxygen supply system.
Meanwhile, COVID cases continue to pile up in Kashmir, with almost 5,000 cases and 50-plus deaths being reported on a daily basis. Authorities have already extended the lockdown in the region.
As second wave of COVID-19 pandemic continues to take toll on healthcare system here, experts believe the worst is still ahead. Amid the unprecedented surge of the infections, Good Samaritans are lending a helping hand to the needy, even as fear and anxiety loom large. Said Ali Safid, Indian administered Kashmir.
According to Afghanistan's Interior Ministry, nearly 200 civilians were killed and some 400 others were injured following the Taliban's increasing attacks since the beginning of the fasting month of Ramadan.
As their statement says, most of the victims were targeted either by roadside bomb blasts, car bomb attacks or targeted assaults. This comes as intense fighting is underway between the Afghan National Army and Taliban militants across some key provinces in southern and northern parts of the country.
Meanwhile, top military officials in Kabul say that counter-attack operations conducted by Afghan government forces have claimed the lives of nearly 1,000 Taliban militants over the same period.
The resolute and quick response of our brave armed forces defeated Taliban in the battles in key districts, mainly in Kandahar and neighboring Helmand province in southern parts of Afghanistan. This is why they use roadside bombs and car bomb attacks as new tactics to resist. Of course, they will fail.
While the Afghan government and the Taliban are struggling to have the upper hand on the battlefields, local Afghans continue to view the controversial Afghan peace talks as the only possible way for bringing calm and security to their war-ravaged country after years of instability.
Decades-long war in our countries prove that there would be no victory for anybody through militarism. Both sides should forget about war and continue to negotiate as a logical way for ending the misery in our nation.
Recently, U.S. Special Envoy for Afghanistan Zalmay Khalilzad said the Taliban have shown a green light to the Istanbul summit on the Afghanistan peace process. The summit was scheduled for April 24th, but it was postponed after the Taliban refused to attend it amid postponement of the withdrawal of the U.S. troops from Afghanistan. In a peace deal between Washington and the Taliban signed in the Qatari capital, May the 1st was designated as the deadline for the U.S. troops pullout. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
The Democratic Front for Liberation of Palestine held a press conference warning that Israeli regime will face retaliatory measures over its ongoing attacks in Jerusalem al-Quds. Palestinian resistance in the Gaza Strip marked Saturday as a day of popular rage along the border fence, where the resistance announced a return of military clashes with the Israeli army and firing incendiary balloons toward Israel in response to the crimes committed in Jerusalem al-Quds.
What is happening in Jerusalem al-Quds is systematic apartheid policy that aims to demolish the Palestinian cause. The recent eviction of Palestinians in Sheikh Jarrah is totally refused by Palestinians. So the resistance in Gaza announces the return of clashes on the borders and calls for a new uprising if these violations continue.
In a recent speech, resistance leaders warned that Israel should bear the responsibility over the recent attacks against Palestinian residents in occupied East Jerusalem al-Quds, saying the resistance is ready to defend Jerusalem with all means.
We hold the Israeli regime responsible for the consequences of the crimes in Jerusalem al-Quds. Palestinian resistance won't sit idle against the killing and eviction of Palestinians. Jerusalem is our red line. All Palestinian groups are united in responding to these crimes, and the response will be heavy.
Palestinians called on the international community and all Muslim nations to support Palestinians and do actions to stop the Israeli violations of Palestinians and the ongoing attacks of the holy places in Jerusalem.
Palestinians are all united in the face of these Israeli crimes. We are calling on Islamic nations to stand by Palestinians and stop these Israeli violations. Our main goal is protection of the holy city.
Palestinian worshippers clashed with the Israeli regime late Friday at Al-Aqsa Mosque in an escalation of weeks of violence in Jerusalem.
Palestinian resistance here holds the Israeli regime responsible for the attacks against Palestinians in Jerusalem Al-Quds, announcing they are ready to respond. Ruba Shabit, Gaza.
Muslims across Italy have virtually observed and taken part in the International Al-Quds Day on Saturday, the day after the last Friday in the holy month of Ramadan. A commemoration was held in the form of a video conference titled Jerusalem Al-Quds. The initiative was attended by authoritative figures from the Islamic community in Italy. The virtual gathering sent out a strong message of undivided solidarity with the people of Palestine in demanding self-determination, independence, and dignity.
Since 1948, the Zionist entity has embarked on a program of oppression of Palestinians, cancellation of our history, culture, art, and architecture, a program of ethnic cleansing. Jerusalem is our stronghold and the capital of Palestine. It's time for the international community to address the normalization deals signed by some Arab countries, which is an act of war against us.
Video conference speakers stressed the fact that as the occupation in Palestinian territories continues, the Israeli occupiers are annexing more areas, killing more civilians, crushing all political resistance, and shutting down free press. This comes amid the growing indifference of the international community.
The Italian media have increasingly failed to report on the Palestinian struggle over the past years. On Thursday, the Italian Foreign Minister Luigi Di Maio met with his Palestinian counterpart Riyad Maliki in Rome, but the encounter went utterly unnoticed by the media.
Over the past years, we have recorded a growing lack of attention to the Palestinian struggle. There appears to be a plan to eradicate humanity from our existence. It is so much easier to control people with no humanity, and the COVID crisis has made this process much smoother.
Al-Quds Day was first introduced by Ayatollah Khomeini in 1979 and has become an annual affirmation of the Muslims' solidarity with the people of Palestine in the struggle for the liberation of Jerusalem Al-Quds. Max Civili, Rome.
Aziz vatandaşlarımız, kıymetli basın mensupları.
The Turkish health minister said the number of new infected cases with the coronavirus has declined due to lockdown measures imposed by the government over the past 15 days. Fahrettin Koca also said the decline was also seen in the number of fatalities. Turkey has been under lockdown since April 29th in an attempt to curb the spread of the virus. The lockdown will last till May 17th, with only tourists and those working in critical jobs allowed to move. The government introduced those measures after the daily infected numbers hit 60,000 cases per day. The health minister said more than 10 million people in the country have been given the second dose of the vaccine, with more than 14 million others receiving their first dose.
Turkey has inked agreements for a total of 240 million doses of the coronavirus vaccines developed by the Chinese firm Sinovac, Pfizer-BioNTech, and Russia's Sputnik V.
The Turkish health minister announced previously that if the daily number of infections does not reach 5,000 per day, new measures are to be implemented. Analysts say that the government must take things slow and not risk opening the country again, even if this could affect the economic situation.
That
Despite the optimism of our health minister, his remarks show that the number of daily infections has still not reached the number set by the government, which is 5,000 to reopen the country. So I think with the data we have now, the country may go into another lockdown after May 17th, especially that the number of those vaccinated is nearly 25% of citizens.
Looking at the latest numbers given by the health ministry, it seems that Turkey must continue with the lockdown to decrease the numbers of daily infections. However, the vice president has already nulled any extension of lockdown. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
As COVID-19 cases continue to surge in Indian-administered Kashmir, Mohammad Afaq Saeed has been swamped with distress calls from people looking for oxygen. Afaq leads the oxygen campaign of a Srinagar-based NGO. His small team of dedicated volunteers is working round the clock to help COVID patients gasping for breath.
We have one of the biggest oxygen programs in this region, in Kashmir. We have a lot of oxygen cylinders and a lot of oxygen concentrators and non-invasive ventilation machines and other supportive equipment. So this way, a lot of pressure from hospitals has been released.
With the Himalayan region's healthcare system reeling under tremendous pressure, Good Samaritans and social organizations have come forward to extend helping hand to people in need. Athrod Kashmir, a prominent philanthropic organization based out of Kashmir's summer capital, has converted the region's Hajj House into a spacious 100-bed COVID center. The facility aims to cater to the rising number of COVID patients requiring hospitalization.
We have established this facility in collaboration with state administration. The facility has 28 beds with high-flow oxygen capacity and 72 beds with oxygen supply. We will add 100 more beds here with oxygen support system very soon.
As hospitals are scrambling to shore up oxygen supplies, the authorities have decided to install over 30 new oxygen generating plants in the region. Also, the government is constructing a 500-bedded COVID hospital in central Kashmir's Budgam district.
The work on this project is to be completed within 35 to 40 days. The hospital will have 125 beds as intensive care unit, and rest of the beds will have oxygen supply system.
Meanwhile, COVID cases continue to pile up in Kashmir, with almost 5,000 cases and 50-plus deaths being reported on a daily basis. Authorities have already extended the lockdown in the region.
As second wave of COVID-19 pandemic continues to take toll on healthcare system here, experts believe the worst is still ahead. Amid the unprecedented surge of the infections, Good Samaritans are lending a helping hand to the needy, even as fear and anxiety loom large. Saidli Safid, Indian administered Kashmir.
The International Quds Day procession started peacefully immediately after the Friday prayers across Nigeria. In Abuja, members of the Islamic movement marched through some major streets and chanted anti-Israeli slogans. The demonstrators voiced support for the oppressed people of Palestine, saying the Quds Day has many significance.
One of the significance is that the people have been coming out, joining. Whenever people were oppressed, they learn how to come out and challenge oppressors at all costs. And here in Nigeria, we also learn from the Imam Khomeini's call. And here we are today calling for the freedom of the Palestinians, at the same time calling for the freedom of our leader, Sheikh Ibrahim Zakzaki.
Free, free Palestine!
The procession came to an end and most of the protesters dispersed after security forces attacked them with tear gas canisters and live rounds. The Islamic movement says over 100 of its members, including women, were arrested and one person was shot.
The government has no power, no bullet, no military, no police when it comes to Boko Haram, when it comes to kidnappers. But they have every power, they have every prompt response to the Shiites whenever they are demanding for the freedom of either our leader or freedom for Palestine.
Meanwhile, in a statement, the Islamic movement in Nigeria said that terror
has never been its mode of operation. The Islamic movement added, its jail leader, Sheikh Ibrahim al-Zazaki, has always believed in peace in all religious activities. The Islamic movement called on the government to release Sheikh Ibrahim al-Zazaki. Nanjum Abdullahi, Abuja.
The remaining signatories of the Iran nuclear deal, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the JCPOA, meet again in Vienna after a week-long break. Iranian lead delegate, Deputy Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi, says all sides are serious in their attempts to find a solution and revive the agreement. A major sticking point has been the list of sanctions that need to be removed by the U.S., which withdrew from the deal under the Trump administration in 2018.
The news we are getting from the Americans indicates that they are also serious about returning to the deal. Up until now, they have announced their readiness to lift a big portion of the sanctions. However, in our view, those are still not all of the sanctions that need to be removed, so negotiations will continue until all our demands are met.
Araghchi says there are still serious differences that need to be negotiated. Iran has made it clear it will only return to full compliance after the U.S. lifts all sanctions imposed, reimposed, or relabeled following Washington's withdrawal, and that it would only do so after it has verified their effective removal. The U.S. team led by Special Envoy Rob Malley has been engaged in talks with the European, Russian, and Chinese delegations in Vienna over the past weeks, but there have been no direct talks with Iran. While expert groups restart work on a draft agreement, Russian envoy Mikhail Ulyanov says delegations seem to be ready to stay in Vienna as long as necessary to achieve their goal. Iran's lead delegate says the Vienna talks are not tied to the Islamic Republic's upcoming presidential elections, and that the top priority for his team is to protect the definitive positions expressed by the country's top officials. Homa Leski, Vienna.
Marking International Quds Rally has been a usual move for Afghans over the recent years, but the threats coming from terrorist groups have prompted them to mark the event in other ways, such as holding seminars and special exhibitions. They say Afghans can fully feel the pain and misery that Palestinians are tolerating since the Israeli invasion of Palestine, because Afghans themselves have felt how difficult is the living conditions on the war, invasion and oppression due to decades of war that's still adding to the number of graveyards in this war-weary country.
This is our responsibility, to keep supporting the oppressed nation of Palestine, especially because we have commonalities with Palestinians in terms of tolerating war, invasion and oppression.
Apart from such similarities between Afghans and Palestinians, all Muslims, including Afghans, look to Al-Quds as their first Qibla that is occupied by the apartheid regime of Israel. Therefore, they say every single Muslim is responsible to raise his or her voice for liberation of Palestine as a Muslim land.
The matter of Quds is not limited to Palestine, as our first Qibla is located there. So defending Palestine means defending Islamic values. In other words, supporting the Palestinian cause means struggling to return back the occupied Palestine to the Islamic world.
Besides religious issues that link Palestine and its nation to the rest of Muslims, the vast violation of Palestinians' rights by the Israeli regime is also unacceptable for Muslims. That is why marking the International Quds Day is considered as a move to convince the international community to adopt logical measures against the Zionist regime that continues to occupy more Palestinian lands. Calls for the liberation of Palestine are not limited to the Muslim world. Many other independent rights bodies and non-Muslim communities, mainly in the US and Europe, have also raised their voices in condemnation of Israel's inhuman acts. They believe that Palestinians will finally accomplish in their struggle to liberate their territories. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Scotland is at a crossroads yet again, a historic election that'll set the course of economic recovery and possibly open up a path towards independence from the UK. But this election, too, divisions among the voters persist.
I guess what we're looking for is a little bit of autonomy from Westminster, says the English person. We're looking for better healthcare.
Positive change for everyone.
Big one for me is about the referendum. I don't want to go down that route again.
First Minister Nicola Sturgeon, whose Scottish Nationalist Party looks set to win, says her priority, first and foremost, will be the economy, but that if voters give her the mandate for another referendum, she won't hesitate.
I think it will unleash a permanent crisis. I mean, the growth of the SNP, the appetite for independence, although we didn't secure a majority during in Indyref 1, it doesn't show any sign of diminishing to any great extent. The numbers go up and down by 1 or 2 degrees. It's something which is almost permanent.
Parties hoping to scupper that plan, the Conservative, Labour and Liberal Democratic, who wish to stay in the UK. The SNP have been in power for more than a decade now, and they haven't exactly received praise for their performance in health and education, for example. But Nicola Sturgeon's response to the pandemic, her handling of the health crisis, has made her a popular leader, leaving many voters to forgive the SNP for their less successful performance in those other areas. If the SNP doesn't achieve a majority, Sturgeon could need to enter a coalition with other pro-independence parties for another referendum to become possible. Her next hurdle would be approval from British Prime Minister Boris Johnson, who hasn't minced his words.
This is not the time to have a reckless and, I think, irresponsible second referendum. We had one only a few years ago.
The first independence referendum was held in 2014. Europhile Scots voted to remain part of the UK so they could stay in the European Union. But then came Brexit and changed that calculus. Now they're seeking re-accession, and the only way to re-enter the bloc is to exit the United Kingdom. Saeed Puriza, Edinburgh.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Of evergreen forests, under the starry sky of the desert, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains. Close up, Iran.
Hello.
I am Mitra, an Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company. I am now in one of the oldest streets of Tehran. Today I've invited my grandma for iftar. One of the sweets that we Iranians serve for iftar in the holy month of Ramadan is zulbia. So today I've come to an old confectionery which sells zulbia for over 40 years. My grandma, who has a sweet tooth, loves the zulbia which is baked in this confectionery. Oh, what a long queue! I can't stand in long lines, so I'd better go to the house of Bibi Shahrzad for buying zulbia. The zulbia which is baked in this confectionery is also very crispy and delicious. Zulbia is a crunchy sweet, which doesn't need to be kept in refrigerator. This sweet is usually baked and distributed in the month of Ramadan. You can always find it at cloths spread for iftar during this month in Iran. The exact date of the invention of this treat is not clear. One of the earliest mentions of this delicacy dates back to 1450 AD in India. In the book Tarikh-e Nasiri, we read that at the period of Nasiruddin Shah Qajar rule, this sweet was brought to the king as a souvenir. At the time of Muzaffaruddin Shah rule, this sweet was baked in Iran. In the past, traveling salesmen used to sell zulbia in big trays through the streets and alleys. Today, during the month of Ramadan, almost all confectionaries sell zulbia along other sweets. I am now in the yard of the house of Bibi Shahrzad. She is a veteran confectioner who sells zulbia every year during Ramadan. Bibi Shahrzad uses a wood-burning stove for making zulbia. Firstly, she prepares the special syrup of zulbia. So, she pours water into the pot. Then, she adds the sugar and mixes the water with sugar with a big ladle. Now she adds a handful of crushed cardamom seeds to the mixture and stirs again until the syrup becomes thick and ready. She puts the syrup aside and puts some starch in a container. Then she adds some yogurt to the starch and mix them together. Now she adds some flour, oil, saffron, and rose water to the mixture, stirs them, and put the container's lid back. Oh well, she puts a big pan full of oil on the fire. Oh, too much oil. In this stage, Bibi Shahrzad ladles some of the prepared batter in a piping bag and holds the piping bag over the hot oil and moves the piping bag in a circular motion, forming a circle twisty shape. after frying, Bibi Shahrzad skims the zulbia and drizzles them with cooled syrup. She finally takes the sweets out of the syrup. Now zulbia is ready to be served in iftar clothes. I bought a kilogram of zulbia from Bibi Shahrzad. My grandma will surely get excited by seeing the tantalizing zulbia. Until next time, goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
The debate.
Hello and welcome to Debate. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Thanks so much for being with us. On Saturday, multiple explosions took place in the Afghan capital of Kabul. The death toll has risen to 68. Most of the casualties have been high school girls as the explosions took place outside of the school when the girls were on their way home. At least 160 others were also wounded. Now, the Afghan government has blamed the Taliban. However, the Taliban has denied involvement. What is going on in Afghanistan as we have seen a rise in attacks since Washington has announced its pull-off from the country by September the 11th. Let's cross over to Kabul, joined by Amin Alami. Amin, thanks so much for being with us. Please fill us in on the latest situation.
Well, Marzia, Kabul residents witnessed another tragic day as back-to-back explosions hit a high school in western part of the capital, Kabul. According to official statistics, at least 68 civilians, most of them schoolgirls, were killed and over 150 others sustained injuries. Most of the injured victims of this incident were shifted to nearby hospitals as well as to Kabul's emergency hospital for war victims. I went to the blast scene as well as I visited some of the victims of this incident in Kabul's emergency hospital. Marzia was one of those students who has sustained injuries. She said that when we were leaving the school to home, a huge car bomb blast happened in front of the entrance gate of this school, and then I cannot remember what happened. Another man who was a shopkeeper also said that when I heard a very loud explosion, I rushed to the blast scene as I was looking for my own daughter there. He also said that after a few moments there was another blast, and it was a roadside bomb blast, and after a few minutes there was the third blast. That is why the casualties are high. According to witnesses and local residents in Qalainau area in western part of the Afghan capital Kabul, the blasts were too huge, and maybe stuff the families who live close to this high school have lost one or two of their family members. This comes as the Afghan government, specifically the Afghan President Mohammad Ashraf Ghani, strongly blamed, condemned the incident, and blamed the Taliban militant group for being behind such attack. But the Taliban also released a statement and condemned the attack and said, "We are not involved in launching attacks on civilian targets." But in the meantime, let's not forget that the Afghan capital, Kabul, as well as many other big cities of this country witnessed similar attacks in the past as well. Most of those attacks were claimed by the Daesh terrorist group. For instance, I can point out at least three deadly terrorist attacks on educational centers in western part of the Afghan capital, Kabul, that claimed the lives of at least 150 school students and university students that were claimed by the Daesh terrorist group. However, the rise of insecurity and bloodshed in Afghanistan comes as there are also efforts to bring peace and stability to this country via relying on negotiations.
All right, thanks so much. I mean, for that,
is one of the players that stress on following the negotiations. Besides the Afghan government, the people of Afghanistan and many other rights bodies as well as independent international bodies also call on the Taliban as well as on what they name it, the supporter of Taliban to say yes to the demand of the Afghan people.
Okay, thanks so much. I mean, I think you have a delay. I'm not sure if you can hear me or not, but that we're going to end that with Amin Alami, correspondent in Kabul, because I definitely want to get to our main guests for this program. I'd like to welcome our guest, Madia Benjamin, co-founder of Code Pink out of Washington, D.C., and Elijah McNear, journalist and political analyst out of Brussels. Thank you both for being with us. Madia, let me start with you. I mean, we look at the situation in Afghanistan and this unbelievable violence that is taking place, and we look at the involvement of the United States, 20 years in that country. What has been accomplished? Because it definitely seems that security is one of those things that has not been really brought to Afghanistan. So what has the U.S. been doing in that country all these years?
Well, it's quite horrific that after almost 20 years of U.S. occupation and billions and billions, if not trillions of dollars being spent, including $88 billion just training the Afghan security forces, that the U.S. and the allies have not been able to build a stable democratic government in Afghanistan. And so the violence is a testament to the fact that the United States has been part of that violence rather than being any solution that would bring peace and security to the Afghan people.
Elijah, we have seen an increase in attacks in Afghanistan recently. Why do you think that this is happening at this point in time? On the one hand, if we look at the attacks yesterday, the government pointed a finger at the Taliban. The Taliban denied involvement and said they do not attack civilians. And as our correspondent said, it has similar earmarks to what Daesh and others have been doing. But overall, what's your perspective about this increase?
Yes, I do really agree with your correspondent. This has had the fingerprint of ISIS rather than the Taliban. There is also a significant indication of the failure of the local security forces. I mean, the car has been there for 24 hours, and this area has been targeted before. And ISIS doesn't really target specific objective to send a message, but it's a random against civilians. This is not the way that Taliban has been doing, particularly after the negotiations that have been held in Qatar and in other places, and the will of the U.S. to withdraw, although the U.S. did not respect its deal that was concluded by Donald Trump of the withdrawal of the 1st of May. And that increases the tension in the country and increases the instability. And now Biden is saying he's going to withdraw by the 11th of September. And that puts also Taliban off its commitment, because it is not guaranteed that Taliban is not going to stop attacking the U.S., particularly when the U.S. are continuing to bomb areas under the Taliban control. Therefore, it is obvious that the security in the country is going to be hectic as long as the Americans are there and as long as there is no national reconciliation among all parties.
Lydia, why do we not see international condemnation and outrage at this increased number of attacks and fatalities taking place in Afghanistan? I mean, if we look at the situation yesterday outside of a girls' high school, if it had taken place anywhere else, we would be seeing so much people condemning what has taken place, memorials set up to remember the victims. Why isn't that the case when it comes to Afghanistan?
I think a lot of the world has turned a blind eye and washed their hands of what's going on in Afghanistan. The violence has been going on for more than 20 years. And here in the United States, there's a sense of let's just get out of there and get over this. So I think such a horrific attack that, as you say, would have made headline news all over the world is really disregarded and seen as just a part of the landscape of a place like Afghanistan. And it's just astounding that there's not more of an international outcry.
I mean, you talked about the United States. Let's talk about inside the United States, because in general, when something like this happens, exactly like you said, in a country like Afghanistan that has been under violence so long, Medea, people basically sometimes look at, well, that's just how they are over there, and not connecting the role of the U.S. government and the troops, the American troops that are there, and the lack of stability in this country. Your take, Medea.
Yes, I think the narrative is those people just fight each other. And one has to question the role of the U.S. and also where do all these weapons come from? And so much of the weapons on all sides have come from the United States that has just poured weapons into Afghanistan and all of the Middle East. And so many of the U.S. weapons companies have become enriched by this violence that's ongoing in Afghanistan and the larger region. And if the United States, after 20 years, was not able to bring any kind of stability to Afghanistan, then it has to be questioned, what was it doing? Why is the government in Afghanistan so corrupt? Was the U.S. part of this corruption? Well, of course, pouring all this money in, and the U.S. military can't even acknowledge where many, many billions of dollars goes. And then blames the Afghans for being corrupt and blames the Afghan for being violent.
Elijah, in any situation, I mean, if we look at these attacks, usually we ask the question, who benefits from these attacks? And you said that it was not the trademark of the Taliban, these attacks that took place yesterday, but more likely Daesh. If we look at then Daesh, and who has supported Daesh, and who has armed Daesh, does it not lead back the trail to many Western capitals?
This is a very good question. We've seen since the war in Afghanistan, 2001, we saw the growing of the Mujahideen that goes back to the U.S. finance during the Soviet era and the Soviet war in Afghanistan. And this is exactly what Hillary Clinton said. The people we are fighting today are the same people we have funded. This is really from the mouth of the foreign minister, the U.S. foreign minister. And as your guest said, I really agree. We see corruption wherever the U.S. are going. We saw that in Iraq is exactly the same, hundreds of billions of dollars. We see the increase of Mujahideen, we see the increase of ISIS in Syria. The Americans watch them growing in Iraq and crossing from Iraq to Syria and said nothing, and then supporting these terrorist groups also in Syria, training them and financing them. So it's exactly, history is repeating itself. ISIS is in Afghanistan as it is in the rest of different parts of Africa and the Middle East. But is also, we see how strongly the U.S. invested in destabilizing the area, and it is time for them to leave, but leave not only Afghanistan, but leave Iraq and leave Syria.
But in your perspective, does the U.S. profit from a lack of stability? We see, for example, well, we're talking about Afghanistan right now, so I'll leave it right there with Afghanistan. Does the U.S. benefit from a lack of stability in these countries?
Well, certainly there's a sector of the economy in the U.S. that benefits all of these defense contractors or military contractors that have made so many billions of dollars in the last 20 years want to see these wars continue. But I certainly don't think it's something that benefits the American people, because we have been paying for these wars instead of the money going into healthcare and education and things that benefit people in this country. They've been going to support the violence and the chaos that the U.S. military is part of in Afghanistan and elsewhere.
Elijah, your prognosis in general with the situation that has happened, of course, the U.S. was supposed to leave in May, and now it says in August. And as you said, technically, then there's no agreement between the U.S. and the Taliban. Now, do you see these talks continuing at this point, or your prognosis, especially for the next few months?
I think talks to reach a conclusion in Qatar, and when the Americans sat with the Taliban and concluded the deal, there is no more talk to be made, at the exception of the U.S. leaving the country. However, we see alarming indication from the U.S. saying we will not completely leave, and we will keep a kind of counterterrorism units to keep watching what's happening in the country.
Yes.
I mean, after 100,000 troops, they didn't manage to do so. Taliban today control 30% of the districts. The other 30% that are also contested. Therefore, after 20 years with 100,000 troops, what the hell the Americans are still doing in the country? There is no justification. The deal has been made, and they should have respected it, and they should have left on May. And now Biden is begging for the Taliban not to attack, because during the attack, the forces are more vulnerable. And Taliban said, we're not going to respect it because you did not respect the deal. So that's it.
Well, Elijah, what do you think that means, this anti-terror group that Washington says has to remain? What do you get from that?
I get that they will keep some kind of control on the local government. They would like to keep the dictate on the government in Kabul to make sure that their interests are still looked after in the country. Therefore, I don't think the Americans will permanently leave and definitely let the Taliban and the central government and all the other groups sit around the table and sort out their own problems. That's also not something easy to achieve. A domestic national reconciliation is not going to be so easy, but the Americans would like to keep a foothold in the country, and that is under a different title, and that they call it counterterrorism. If they consider the Taliban are no longer a threat, then there is no reason to keep the counterterrorism units in the country.
Your take on that, Madia, because we've seen, for example, we saw troops leaving Iraq, but then not really leaving Iraq. And now, as our other guest has said, about the anti-terror troops that Secretary of State said that would be left there in Afghanistan. Your assessment of all this, when the United States sees the situation, for example, Afghanistan is very important to it strategically, do you think that really that Washington is going to totally leave Afghanistan?
Well, it will certainly maintain the ability to come back in with airstrikes, with drone strikes. There will be CIA operatives. There will be people still training the untrainable Afghan military after 20 years of training. So they won't be totally gone. But I do think it is a positive thing. I agree that the troops should have left by May 1st and it would have made the withdrawal easier. But I do think it is a positive thing that the U.S. troops will leave and hopefully most of the contractors as well. But let's not kid ourselves. The U.S. is not going to totally wipe its hands from Afghanistan. It wants to maintain some ability to go back in.
Well, Medea, based on what you're saying, then do you see continued instability? Because if we're talking about drone strikes or being able to attack at any time, so it means, for example, if Kabul, if the government or whichever government is in power by that time and doesn't walk the walk that the United States defines, then wouldn't it be even easier for them to cause even more instability, and especially with CIA operatives on the ground?
Well, we've seen from this attack, if indeed it was ISIS, that there is that there are different kinds of groups. And let's remember, there are all kinds of warlords in Afghanistan that will be jockeying for power. It's not just the Afghan government and the Taliban. So there will be, unfortunately, a lot of violence for years to come because there are so many different groups vying for power and there are so many weapons. And this is become the occupation of so many of the Afghan men that I don't think we're going to see an end to the violence in the short term.
Elijah, your prognosis for Afghanistan beyond August?
I really agree. I don't think there is going to be stability as long as there is no national reconciliation in the country. And that is really important to allow the Afghani to sort out their own problems, whatever time they need, how long they need, it doesn't matter. Even, yes, I agree there are many warlords. The country has been under a war for 20 years. That's not easy. There's a lot to be done, reconstructing also the souls and the national reconciliation. That is not going to be easy. But it will take time, but it's better to start with without the Americans, without the presence of any foreign troop. Let the people of the Middle East and the West Asia sort out their own problems.
And, Madia, 1 minute I have. I mean, this war was started in 2000 war, allegedly the war on terror by George W. Bush. In your perspective, what has been accomplished in these 20 years by the United States and Afghanistan?
Countless numbers of Afghans killed, millions displaced, millions wounded, thousands of U.S. soldiers, over $1 trillion U.S. dollars sunk into all of this chaos and bloodshed. That's what's been, quote, accomplished in these 20 years, and it's horrific. And unfortunately, on top of all that, I don't think in the U.S. the lessons have been learned that we shouldn't go in and invade and occupy other countries.
And with that note, I appreciate both of you being with us on this debate. Medea Benjamin, co-founder of Code Pink out of Washington, D.C., and Elijah McNeil, journalist and political analyst out of Brussels. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another debate. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Goodbye.